Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
46% of Americans expect to leave behind financial obligations when they pass away, so it's crucial to make sure your family is financially protected. Policy Genius helps you find the right life insurance coverage by comparing options from America's top insurers with help from licensed, award-winning agents. Secure your financial future with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get free life insurance quotes in just a few clicks. That's policygenius.com.
Oh, hey, everybody. Episode 13 of Quarantine Cast coming at you. It is Wednesday. We are halfway through the final week of the Quarantine Cast. Again, I'd like to just start by thanking everybody for following through this long with us. 13 episodes, 13 really good conversations. Phil, you still good? You hanging in there, buddy?
Yes, I'm doing great. It's been a weird weather day. It snowed. We woke up to a few inches of snow, and now I went to go check the mail, and the snow is already gone. So
yeah, it was
pretty typical
weird weather day. It's a very nervous day for me, Phil. I've had a fine day, but I'm verging on what could be a bit of an issue, but not a breakdown, but close. A lot of states are starting to close hunting seasons, close fishing seasons. There's a big mixed message if you go state by state, but it's that the COVID-19 pandemic is starting to really affect people's time outside. So I know it's affected your potential first turkey hunt that got canceled, and so we'll have to reschedule that. But in the meantime, I want to read you, Phil, a list of things that we've compiled. Hopefully, by the time you listen to this, this will be on themeateater.com. We're going to have a running list of updates and changes to fishing and hunting regulations on our website. And, of course, if you see something or hear of something in your neck of the woods, email us at meateater@themeateater.com or thc@themeateater.com. Either one. Email us and let us know what's going on locally or regionally with you so we can help report on all the changes to regulations during the pandemic. But I'll just read as of this moment, non-resident turkey tag sales have been suspended in Nebraska. Resident tag sales remain unchanged. Non-residents who have already purchased tags are still allowed to use them. I personally meant to go over to Nebraska this year and do a South Dakota-Nebraska turkey tour. And I was thinking about trying to convince you to come with me, Phil, but that looks like at least half of that trip is no good. Hence I'm pretty nervous. Can you talk me down off this ledge here, man? I can't lose turkeys. I can't.
I when this whole thing started, we were kind of, at least the outdoor industry people in it, were pretty optimistic, but it seems to be creeping in. Yeah, but I mean, you'll still do some turkey hunting, right? I mean, you're like, what has Montana done so far? Is there a list of that?
Nothing. I did get a hold of our good buddy Greg from Montana FWP, so hopefully we'll have him on tomorrow or the next day, some point this week, to update us on what they're doing. I mean, this is their state who really relies on their outdoor economy, so he'll be able to update us on what's going on in Montana and hopefully give me personally some good news. But if you go through, you know, kind of go through the updates of what's happening around this country, Washington has canceled the six game management units that were scheduled to begin their spring bear hunting on April 1st. That will not open. The Game and Fish is going to reassess opening hunting seasons on April 6th. The youth spring turkey hunt in Washington State is scheduled for 4 to 5th is canceled. In South Carolina, all of the Department of Natural Resources turkey lottery hunts have been canceled. In North Carolina, some state parks and associated game lands and boat ramps are closed to public access. In Utah, the Arches and Canyonlands National Parks are closed until further notice. Glacier National Park in Montana is closed until further notice. And on we go. Michigan DNR suspended all charter fishing and guide operations. So across this country, that we're dealing with changes. Some of them are positive. Some states are relaxing fishing regulations and such to get more people outside. But it seems like this may be coming more frequently within the next couple of days. So
tough. I mean, it's really easy to get all worked up and anxious and upset. I would argue at the same time that like Washington State is kind of where the coronavirus first popped up in the United States in large numbers around Seattle. And, you know, besides New York City, Seattle is, you know, one of the bigger hotspots in the country right now. And they've been pushing hard for the quarantining and the shelter in place and the lockdowns. And they're seeing huge results. It's already slowing down a ton. So it's kind of, you know, do you play it extra careful and have this whole outbreak last a shorter amount of time so we can get back to life as usual more quickly? Or do we kind of play fast and loose and risk this pandemic just lasting longer? You know, I'd say, you know, it's it's no good for anyone, obviously, but you know, it's making hard decisions.
Yeah, it is. And you know, in the grand scheme of things, I can not help but be melodramatic about the loss of turkey hunting possibly, or bear hunting even at that. But, you know, as long as you're safe and happy and healthy, that's the blessing that I hope for everyone. So as much as it will pain me if I can't go turkey hunting, it will pain me much, much worse if someone in my social circle or my family gets stricken with this illness. So I felt maybe, and I've said this before in earlier podcasts, I felt maybe we'd be insulated from this in the outdoor space just because of the kind of the functionality of what we do and that it often is removed from crowds. And but there are other factors involved here. So hopefully we'll keep you updated on the quarantine cast in the next couple of days. We'll try to make sure we track this. And then when we get back to our regularly scheduled show, we'll continue to track it. And as a service to everyone that listens. And also you can go, like I said, go to keepcheckingthemeateater.com. We are going to make sure that there is a page that gets updated frequently with all these closings that keeps you not only in your own state, but in the states around you, what you can and can't be doing outside. It's an important break. It's an important distraction, and we need it. And so hopefully we can all do it safely and without, you know, spreading this virus any more than it already has. So that's it. That's all we'll say for today. You'll get some more updates tomorrow. But for now, Phil, we're going to forget about all that and talk about turkeys. I had a delightful conversation. Lots of laughs. I really like Danielle Pruitt. I know you will too. Enjoy her from down there in Texas talking how to eat turkeys and what it was like to hunt her first one last year. Enjoy. Hey, Danielle, what's going on down there?
Not much. Just trying to stay cool because it's already hot.
I you said it was 90 degrees in Texas?
I think last week we got to 90.
That's
I want to say, yeah, we're like in the sunscreen wearing phase of the year.
Well, enjoy short weather. We just got about 3 inches of snow in Bozeman this morning. So enjoy what you got for now.
Oh man, I don't miss that.
You can come see us in July. And this is, I was just thinking about this. I didn't say anything. Is this your first time on my podcast?
It is.
That's no way. There's no way. You haven't been on here before?
I know. No, I mean, I feel like every time I make the mistake of not announcing to the whole crew that when I do come to Bozeman, I just sort of show up. And whenever you're always gone, I think.
Yeah, that's
you're
true.
You're sort of missing.
Well, it's took being quarantined for us to get together and record a podcast. So.
Yeah.
I'm very happy about that. So welcome to the show. We should, I guess we should start with, hopefully everybody knows at least who you are and that you're a big part of Meat Eater's culinary content with Wild and Whole. So let's maybe just start with kind of how you got into this whole thing. Because I remember when I was first introduced to you, I remember thinking, well, I've not heard of her, but she looks like she has the right stuff to do this on a larger scale. I was very excited to work with you early on, and I think it's blown up and turned into something maybe you didn't even think it could be. But like, how did you start Wild and Whole?
It was sort of by accident. I was looking for a creative outlet. I was working a 9-to-5 desk job that I didn't entirely love. And so I was already cooking a ton of wild game, and I picked up a camera because I just sort of thought it was a fun thing to do. And my friends and family were like, you should start a blog. And I was like, no, I don't want to be one of those bloggers. I don't want to do that. But I did. And I actually kept it a secret for it. At least 6 months, I like didn't tell anybody. And then one day Game and Fish North Dakota called me and they're like, hey, can we write a story on you? And I was like, sure. And then that led into like, I worked in an event at Pheasants Forever a few years ago. And then I met Steve and Giannis and Doug Duran at that event. And everything just sort of escalated. And here I am.
Yeah, here you are. Yeah, I mean... Yeah. Did you, you know, when you started working with Meat Eater, you know, first, I think on a freelance basis and then a more official basis here in the last year and some change, like, did you see it going the way it's going now? Because, I mean, you're getting a ton of attention and doing a lot of great work both on our website and just on your own social media. I mean, I think it's been great to watch it grow. What are your feelings on where it is right now, Wild and Whole?
I mean, it's sort of the same. I mean, I think what has changed over the course of the last few years is that I knew that there is a reason why I was doing everything. I just didn't really know how to communicate it. And I think what has really evolved and grown throughout time is exploring why I do what I do, what it is that like, what matters to me most about sharing this message. And I think that voice has really developed. And that's what I'm probably most proud of, is sort of figuring that out instead of just being like, here's a way to cook a roast.
Yeah. Well, let's explore that a little bit, because I've enjoyed some of the bird hunting stuff you've done, and when you shot your first antelope, I believe it was this year, right?
Yep.
And I was there in Texas last year around this time when you shot your first turkey with Giannis.
First hog.
First hog, yeah. First
this year,
hog.
There were three. Those were my three first: turkey, hog, and antelope.
And people that know this show, I mean, I really do love explaining and exploring people's why. I think, you know, if we were to collectively pull all of our perspectives together, we could maybe get a picture of what hunting is. But that's an impossible task. But if you're going to add your why, you know, we already talked about it a little bit in the beginning why you did it. Like, what's your why now? As have you killed your first antelope, killed your first turkey? You know, obviously you're learning how to use the whole animal and to talk about your endeavors. Like, what's the learnings that over the last couple of years?
You know, initially, like I always tell the story of the first time I shot a pheasant in North Dakota years ago. Like my husband had. I think that very first year we were there, I didn't have my hunter safety. So I missed the first season, but Travis was always bringing me birds and was always cooking them. And then the next year was the first year that I actually started hunting, and I shot my first pheasant, cooked it, ate it. And I remember thinking that like, this was unlike any other like meal I'd had before. And it was just such a great feeling and just so much appreciation, gratitude. And I was like, well, I want to eat this way. I want to feel this way every time I eat. And over the years, what I've understood is that, like, the harder that you work for something or the more connected you are to something, the greater appreciation and value you have for your food. And it's just that hunting gives you that direct connection. And it's really what has driven me to start hunting is to find value and appreciation in a world where we look for convenience and everything is just always handed to us so easily. You just go to the grocery store, pick it up, and you don't really think twice about it. And now that I've like been behind a gun and had an animal inside my scope this year, that like the antelope, I immediately felt the burden and responsibility that it wasn't just I'm shooting the responsibility right now to make a clean shot. It was everything that came before. Like, did you prepare for this hunt? Are you prepared for cleaning it? Are you like just all these things? Like all of a sudden I just realized the weight of responsibility that is carried if you're going to shoot an animal. And it's just something that I just really, really appreciate. Having that experience. Yeah. It's really important to me.
I love it. And I think that, you know, I saw it in you too when we were in Texas last year and just thinking about it. There was, I hesitate to bring this up, but I think it's useful for this line of thinking. There was an article written by, we won't say the publication, recently, earlier this year, about, I know you read it because I remember seeing you, I believe, in the comment section of the
social
media. Oh,
I know what you're going to say.
There is this idea floated out there, and I'll do a poor job of encapsulating it, but there was this idea floated out that if folks who came into hunting as just foodies and only came in it, or at least initially came into it motivated by food, were missing out on the bigger picture. They weren't appreciating all that hunting had to offer, therefore didn't necessarily add a bunch to our community, and possibly were a detractor for the overall hunting community. Like I said, I'm not sure I could do a good job to summarize the intent of the article. But in general, I think that's what they were getting at, that there's this foodie trend.
I think they were also getting at, it's really trendy, but when the going gets tough, are you really going to stick around? Like, if you have a bad hunting season one year, are you going to go back out the next?
Yeah.
And I know that feeling so well. When I started hunting, I would get extremely frustrated because I kept missing birds, and we'd be in North Dakota and it's freezing ass cold. I remember like there were days -20 that we were hunting in thick snow, and I would finally get to the end of this creek that we had been pushing, the roosters flush and I shoot and I miss. And I finally was just like, this is stupid. What's the point of hunting if I can't kill anything? Like, why am I out here doing this? And then my husband turned and looked at me, and I'll never forget, he said, if you think hunting is about killing, you're missing the point. And that was the thing that changed everything about hunting for me. I mean, yes, obviously for food is my reason for doing it, but it's just changed so much. And so when I saw that article, and I totally get what they're coming from, and I think it takes just more time in the field to really understand what he's saying. But of course, I come into hunting strictly for food and because I love eating wild game. I like cooking it. So I mean, I thought the whole thing was a little silly.
I was not a fan of it. I thought it was a straw man, you know, as if.
I thought it was just kind of there to like.
Yeah. It was just a
poke. Get some people talking. Yeah.
Just a poke.
Probably.
Yeah, like it was a well-articulated piece. And like every piece it has, I'm not willing to say where it came from or I could send people to read it, but you'll have to take our word for it that it exists. But I did think as I was reading it, I thought of you a lot. And then I saw that you had commented on it. And I thought about, you know, where you came from. It's like, I came into this from a culinary perspective. That's how I'm communicating about my hunting life. But then along the way, you've kind of been forced into all the same conundrums every hunter goes through, right? All the same, you know, all the same issues and problems and struggles. And I think appreciating the food first helps you understand, like, this pheasant tastes delicious. And then the next time you go out and spend 7 days and don't shoot one, it tastes even better the next time that you had to work 7 days. So I saw that in you, and I've appreciated that. So I think it's worth you kind of articulating that to folks is even if you come in through food, if you're a real hunter, you're going to be forced into that feeling, you know?
But I think it's important. I don't think you get to grasp what hunting is without having that experience of failure over and over, because to me, that's really common. And when you're new to this and you get into this, it's like really easy to get on Instagram or flip a magazine and you're like, whoa, look at this elk. I'm just going to buy a tag and that's just going to happen. No, it's not. I think sharing the reality is really important in our industry because a lot of companies don't do that.
Yeah. I've run into that in my career, run into new hunters that just had a warped expectation of what they were getting themselves into. And truthfully, it's hard to, you know, long form conversations like this one and other ones we have at our company are, I think, helping to ease that a little bit. But if you're just relying on social media, you're just getting the highlights. And it's hard. It's hard to get a good perspective of hunting through something like that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we should tell some of your first stories. I wasn't there for any of the other ones, although I imagine that your antelope story is a pretty good one too. But I was at least in camp for your first turkey, and it was a great story. And somewhere is a video of you shooting this turkey that I could watch 1,000 times.
I hope that's still around.
Yanni has it somewhere, but I hope so. It was great. It was absolutely fantastic, and it's those moments where, you know, if this is raw emotion and just like your reaction in that.
You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. Hey, Steve here. I want to talk about something crucial for any outdoor enthusiast, which is battery reliability. I've got Interstate batteries powering my gear. I have Interstate batteries in my camper. I run an Interstate battery in my boats. I use Interstate batteries because the last thing I want is to be left powerless. Interstate batteries isn't just another battery company. They are outrageously dependable. In Alaska, the boat dealer that we use for getting stuff and repairs, he uses Interstate. Whether you're gearing up for hunting season, planning your next RV trip, or getting your boat ready, Interstate has the battery for all your needs. With over 150,000 dealer locations, the power you need is always nearby. Interstate batteries aren't just about power. It's about being prepared for any situation. Don't let a dead battery ruin your adventure. Head over to interstatebatteries.com, use their store locator, and equip yourself with a battery that won't let you down. When you're out in the wild or just on your daily commute, an Interstate battery is your key to a dependable journey.
We probably have to start from the beginning. You want to kick us off as like where we were and what the heck we were even doing?
Yeah, we were in Texas in the hill country. Steve was there, you, Cal was there, and Yanni. Is that it?
Yep.
Just us? Yeah, so Yanni was my guide for the day, if you will. And like that morning, like I guess see in the breaking light a little bit, like some turkeys in a tree, and he was like, and he could hear them. So like we hunkered down and we could hear all these turkeys, and like I just knew, like it's like that feeling like where you just expect that it's just gonna like fly down and walk right to you. I don't know why I thought that would happen, and then it didn't. And then like throughout the rest of the day, like there were moments where I was like, this is it. We're talking to this turkey. And like, I'm like, we're walking all around. And like one of the coolest parts for me was listening to him doing like a crow call. Anything. I was like, why aren't you doing the turkey call? And I guess the way he sort of explained it was a lot like what I imagine. What's that game? Not Risk. Like going to war. Like he's like, I don't want to give away my position yet. He's like, right. It's like if you're in a house with another person and that other person is talking to you, you don't really know like where they're, you can't see them, but you know what room they're in. Like you can locate that person in that room. He's like, every time you talk to a turkey, that turkey knows exactly where you are. So I'm not ready to give my position up. So he's like doing all these other animal calls. And I'm like, what is going on? And like he hears a turkey from so far away, like so far away that I just ignored it.
is this across the Llano River? I
think this is yes.
It's a yeah. Big. It's a big wide open expanse, and as anybody knows, this is what makes Danielle's story crazy, or crazier than what happened, is that generally getting a turkey to cross something like that, some large expanse. I mean, because this is it's a river that has a bunch of like dry islands, kind of like sandy dry islands, and a bunch of rock outcroppings. It's a big. I don't know how long you say it was, like 500-600 yards long, or maybe longer.
Yeah, and then past that point, I would say it was another 500-600 yards up sort of a hill, and then there was a big barn, and then behind that barn was a bunch of trees. At least from what I remember. And I'm like, I don't even see a turkey anywhere. And I can barely even hear this turkey. But Giannis does. And he's calling back. And all of a sudden, like, I finally realize we're having this communication going on. And so he's like, there's a piece of driftwood down by the river. Let's hunker down there. We don't have, like, a blind or anything. We're just in camo. And then he has his little... what do you call that thing? The fan.
His fan.
He has his fan.
Yeah. He was reaping turkeys.
That was my blind. That was my blind. Yeah, and it was just crazy because he was just call back and forth. And I was kind of just like, well, I'm just going to entertain this idea. Like, I just had absolutely no idea that this turkey would come down. It was so far away.
What you didn't know, like, is how unlikely. I mean, even as a turkey hunter myself, that's an unlikely scenario because it wasn't in the middle of the day. Towards the middle of the day,
It was after lunch.
Yeah, it was.
It was
after
like at 2 or 3. It was. Yeah. It was the heat of the day.
Yeah, it was the heat of the day. This turkey is literally across a river, gobbling, and normally. Any real barricade, a fence, a body of water, anything that a turkey has to cross, either fly across or jump over, or any big barricade is kind of the death of a turkey hunt. A turkey gets to a place where it has to really want to be where you are, And if it can't get there and it's got a hen, it's gobbler or the hen, or it's got any other reason not to come all the way. You know, as a turkey hunter, you're trying to coax this thing. The conversation has to be so desperate that the turkey is willing to fly across a river just to check you out.
Yeah, it was like, I want to say we were having this conversation for like at least 30 minutes, because I would watch this turkey like walk down 40 yards and then stop. And I'm like, God, just make up your mind. And then he would come and stop. And I was like, this guy is so annoying. This is taking forever. And then he gets to the river edge and I'm like, what's he going to do? And he flies across the river and like, my heart immediately starts beating out of my chest because I'm like, oh, he's really coming over. Holy shit. I can't believe this is for real. I can't believe he's falling for this. Oh my God. Watching that bird fly across was just nuts.
I remember watching the video and you're like, there's a lot of holy shits coming out of you.
is that right?
Yeah. I think you said holy shit about, he's like, when he landed, holy shit. And he's like, he's coming. Holy shit. I killed him. Holy shit. Yeah, there was a lot of that, which I appreciated. But yeah, I mean, when I just from watching the video, the turkey did kind of that, the little shimmy a turkey does when it's getting ready to take off to fly, you know, puts its feet down, it shimmies, it gets perfect positioning. And in this case, it kind of in the sand, in the gravel, and then took off and flew a couple hundred yards to a bar where it could get up and get to where you guys were. And then it, from what I can remember, it bombed your position. Like that gobbler came, he didn't even strut, I don't think, once. He was head down, coming to get you.
Yeah, I don't remember it that well. I just remember, like, I like to think of myself as a very sensitive person. Not like sensitive, like I'm going to cry, but like emotions feel extremely heightened. And I thought that I was going to have a heart attack when that thing walked up to me. And all I remember is Yanni saying, the moment I'm going to make that noise, and it's going to pop his head up. And that's like all I was waiting for. It was like, just, it was intense. That was so, that was like way more intense than any other hunt I've had by far.
Well, that's why I love turkeys. I'll forever be kind of on the stump for turkeys for that reason. You know, other animals certainly bring out that excitement. A bugling elk always comes to mind when in terms of this, but there's something about turkeys, the time of year, kind of the sound they make, the proximity, there's just something about it. So you could see it. This bird comes up. I remember he comes up. The ridge would have been to your north, and then up onto the up basically parallel to where you are, and starts working along the fence that you're sitting. So he's dropping down in little depressions and popping back up and dropping down and popping back up, and he finally pops back up. And Yanni's just shoot him. And shoot him.
I don't remember that.
I remember watching the video. Like, but that's fairly normal for turkey hunters. Like to be dialed in to. We've had other new hunters on. We had a show last year with new turkey hunters, and it's very similar. You just kind of, it's not a big target, so you are waiting to make that happen, and you pull the trigger, and they flop right over.
Yeah, I was waiting for like a little bit more fireworks to happen and some flopping around, but he really just
federal TSS. Yeah, you put him in the dirt. That was great. Then your reaction, I think, was I from what I can remember, just holy shit.
Yeah, I just like I took my mask off and I looked at Yadis and I was like, shit.
yes. Yeah, shit. We did.
I was like, I can't believe that just happened.
That was awesome. It was a good bird. You know, I was hunting with, who was I hunting with? Cal, maybe? Me and Cal were poking around that day. And we popped over right after you guys had shot this bird, or very, very close after you shot this bird. And you were still hyped up. And it was a great, I mean, everybody killed turkeys that trip. So, I mean, it was a fantastic time. It was a fantastic time. You know, also, like, thinking back to, we get back to camp and you immediately go to plucking the bird whole, like plucking the entire bird. And so I think this is a good point to kind of We were just talking about that you're going to cook the tail of this turkey. Like, how would you, did you have plans? I got my first turkey. Do you have plans of how you wanted to, you know, butcher it and prep it? Or were you just kind of flying by the seat?
I mean, I've cleaned so many other birds so many times that I know, like, I mean, it's not the first, like, wild turkey that I've had to cook, so I knew. No, I mean, I don't know. I didn't have any plans, no. No. I had plans to cook the legs that the next day. That was my only plan. And so other than that, it's like save everything you can. So
yep.
I did have plans for the sponge. That was all I really cared about, was making sure to get a big Tom to have a sponge, which is weird.
All right, we'll walk ahead. That is, you know, the only thing I cared about was the sponge. you don't hear that a lot. Definitely. So you're like, I remember plucking the bird, and I know we cooked the legs up there in camp. But take people through, if you were to now with what you've been through, and you've cooked you got a lot of great recipes on themeter.com for wild birds, especially turkeys. Take people through, you know, butchering a turkey. And then how, you know, you would cook each part. So you got two lobes, two legs, two thighs. Now I have to add the tail in there based on what you told me before you hit record.
Well, I mean, you know, like, you start plucking the tail feathers out because you want to keep it. And then you're like, wow. So this is what I'll say. I think you should obviously you'll keep your breast meat, your thighs, and your drumsticks. But beyond that, the carcass can make a huge batch of stock. And so one of the things that makes stock so great is having something really high in collagen. And those turkey tails are basically just a cartilage-y thing. And so now I don't think you should save the tail just so you can have a nice fried turkey tail sandwich. But it would be good to put it in the stock for sure. Yeah.
For sure,
both. As well as the sponge too. That's my conclusion on the sponge.
So talk us through the sponge, because I think, you know, I'd like people to come away from this like with a sense of turkey season's coming up. God forbid they shut them down. If they do, it's going to take me a long time to recover. They're already shut down bear season in Washington.
I heard that
just today. And non-residents for turkey. I can't even talk about it. I'm going to get upset. I just sent an email to Montana Fish Wildlife Parks, our buddy that's been on the show, Greg Lemon, over there. I'm like, I got to have you on the show. I need you to make me feel better. I can't lose this. I need this. But regardless, I'd love people to come out of this with this idea that there is, every piece of the bird can be used. Forget taxidermy for a minute. Who cares? If you could eat the beard, we would talk about that. I don't think that's in your repertoire. But I would love for people to come, like, with a step-by-step, but with a nice understanding that of all the parts of the bird. So if you want to start, let's start with the sponge, because most people don't even know what that is, let alone what to do with it.
All right, so you've got a nice big tom, and you're going to clean it, and then you're like, the first thing you do is, say, pinch under the skin. Say if you're not going to plug it, you're going to pinch under the skin to rip it open, and then all of a sudden you're like, what is this? And it's this yellowy, jello-y thing that's all over in front of the crop cavity. That is the sponge. Usually only toms have it. I don't think Jake's probably, if they do, it's probably very small. But mine was like this big, like this thick.
Yep.
Toms, males will grow the sponge because it's basically their energy reserve, so that whenever spring rolls around, they have this energy reserve, and all they need to do is focus on mating. They don't eat, they don't do anything, and they just live off all of this fat that they've been storing throughout the winter. Yeah. To my understanding, that's what the sponge is,
very
created for.
Very much so. It's just a mass of tissue that sole purpose is to keep fat for this turkey during these really rough times. I've killed some fighting toms that just look rough after this.
Really?
So you would imagine that they need this reservoir, And it helps, and it keeps their chest plump. It just does a lot of things. And it's just a, you know, it's a curious thing in nature that you see, but it's,
yeah,
it definitely doesn't look delicious. I'll say that.
No. The first time I ever encountered this, Travis shot a turkey in North Dakota, with a huge sponge. And I was just like, the whole thing I think was plucked and the sponge was still like underneath the skin. And I was like, trying to like get like the same way I would treat like a whole roasted turkey or chicken for Thanksgiving. I always separate the skin from the meat to season. And I went to do that and I was just like pulling out globs of that sponge. And I was like freaking out thinking that there was something wrong with this animal because I'd never seen that before. And that time I threw it away because I didn't know what I was looking at. And so like, I started thinking about it and researching what it was. I was like, well, if it's just a big fat reserve, why aren't we saving this? Can you render this fat out? Like what can you, there's got to be some value to this. And so when I saved the sponge, my test was to see if I could render the fat out or find out if this is just like going to taste like horrible because it's like it could be full of like hormones or like something weird, and it's like it's gonna taste really bad. But I'm a guinea pig and I just can't help exploring these things to figure it out. So that's the thing with the sponge. And what I discovered trying to render it out is that it's actually it is fatty, but there's more cartilage to it than actual fat. And so I couldn't get the fat to melt out and render away. So I kept adding water to it so that it wouldn't burn under the heat. And so I kept adding, and then I just kind of tasted the water after like an hour. And I was like, oh my God, that tastes almost like broth. So then I added a whole lot of water and then just simmered it for like 4 hours and strained it. And I got this yellowy, like almost like butter-like consistency because there was fat in it, brothy stuff, and it was really, really good. So in the future, the sponge, I would absolutely put it in the stock because it'll add a lot of flavor and body to your stock.
Was it?
So that's like, the thing with the sponge.
And that technique's called like essentially called wet rendering, right? Or something similar to
look
that.
Look at you.
Did I get it? Look at me. I got some knowledge. That's cool. That's the thing that I enjoyed, you know, going back to our original conversation here about how can somebody learn to hunt but then be teaching people something right after they killed their first turkey. That's something that you taught all of us. And there's an article somewhere on themeateater.com about this experience. I remember reading it when it first came out. So you can go to themeateater.com, and I bet you if you Google turkey sponge edible or turkey sponge Danielle Pruitt, you're going to get something. Might get this podcast.
You're not going to find very many articles on the internet. I have Googled this and I searched and I'm like, can you eat a sponge? And it was like, I couldn't find very much. So first thing that pops up, I'll be very, very disappointed.
me too. It's hard work. So there you go. You got your sponge. Now, did you do heart and liver from this particular turkey?
I did.
Tell us about that.
I don't know. I don't remember what I ended up. Oh, I know what I did. For Thanksgiving, I made giblet gravy with it.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Yeah. That's what I've done in the past with those organs. And I've never just pulled a turkey heart out and like sliced it and cooked it up like you would a deer heart or anything like that. I don't know that it would be worth it for the size, but giblets and gravy is perfect for that.
Yeah. Another thing you can do if you want to eat it right away, and this is something I do with duck hearts and livers or geese or pheasants, anything like bird-like, I just chop it up and like I keep a whole lot of seasonings in the pantry and I'll make like a breakfast sausage blend, like the spices that I would add in a breakfast sausage. And I'll just throw a pinch of that with some onions and then I'll just saute up those chopped hearts and livers and then put it in a hash with some eggs. That's probably one of my favorite things to do with duck hearts and livers.
Yeah, and don't forget, you know, in a wild turkey with a heart especially, and even the gizzard. I mean, you can pickled turkey heart would probably be pretty good, I bet. I've never done it.
You know, I've never had pickled gizzards.
I know Ryan Callahan is a fan of pickling gizzards. I know
he's a fan of pickling everything.
So he took the words right out of my mouth. I was like, he just pickles whatever. He could put the whole turkey in a pickle.
I would like to go through his pantry and like look at the pickling jars, and there's like feet.
There's a t-shirt in this. There's a t-shirt in here somewhere. A pickling jar with a mustache on it. This is the Ryan Callahan Cooking Company. So don't forget that as an homage to Ryan Callahan. Don't forget that you can pickle your gizzards in your hearts. But moving on to the more popular pieces here. Now we're gonna have to talk through turkey legs now, because I have a few recipes for drumsticks that I think work now. But I can tell you, and I would happily admit that I messed up. And I know a lot of people who are seasoned turkey hunters and turkey eaters and the wild turkey that have messed up a lot of turkey leg recipes. They're an easy thing to screw up. You agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's not so much an easy thing to screw up, but it's something that most people just don't have the patience for.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just time.
Yep.
Time will tenderize anything.
There's another.
Probably eat a leather shoe.
Yeah, that's right.
No, but yeah, so unlike other birds, like say a goose, turkeys and even pheasants, they have tendons in the drumstick whenever they cook, and sandhill cranes. I'll add that to the list. Cranes, turkeys, pheasants, when their drumsticks are cooked, those tendons harden up. So, yeah. You know, like if you're tenderizing it and you're like got all those like long bone things in there, those are just the tendons, but you can pull those out before you start cooking or just pick them out of the meat. But yeah, braising it for a very, very, very long time, or pressure cooker, crock pot.
Yep.
That's
do you do ever
way to
like
do
an
it.
Insta? Do you ever use like the Instapot for any of this activity?
I have a pressure cooker. It's not an Instapot.
Same thing. Yeah, I mean, what are your favorite wild turkey legs? We all know this. We probably talked about this on the show before. Turkey legs are haven't traditionally been an appealing thing for hunters, and I don't understand why, because there's so many ways to do it. I mean, I've seen people boil turkey legs. I've seen you can I've seen a million things done. I've seen them braised, of course, in a Dutch oven, like. It's just
boiled.
I've seen people drop turkey legs in a boil before. I've seen people like strip the meat. That sounds awful, doesn't it?
It sounds like very Elmer Fudd. Just pot of boiling water.
I've seen people make ground turkey out of them, which I think is interesting.
I think that's a really good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. That might be something. I've got, I think, maybe 4 wild turkey legs in the freezer for this quarantine. That might be something, now that it sparks my mind, that might be something I can do. But anyway, from your perspective, if you're going to tell people, like, hey, here's three quick ways, you know, maybe not the whole recipe, but 3 quick ways to cook turkey legs, how would you start?
Well, it's not going to be quick.
three very long, arduous ways to eat a turkey leg.
All right. 3 different methods. Let me say it this way. It's the same type of cooking using 3 different methods. Low and slow is like what I like to say. Anything that's really tough, treat it with low heat for a long period of time. So you've got your good old crock pot. I would recommend throwing it in the crock pot on low the night before you plan to eat. And then it might be ready by lunch the next day. And make sure you have plenty of liquids in there so it doesn't dry out. The second thing I would do is pressure cook them. And that's sort of the same philosophy. You would brown it, put it in the pressure cooker with some liquids, and then put it on high for like probably 3 hours or 4 hours at least. And then the third way I did this with a whole venison shoulder recently. That was great. I would, I rubbed it in a marinade, vacuum sealed it, and then put it in a sous vide for like 18 hours. And it was phenomenal. So those are the three ways I would slow cook a turkey leg.
Yeah. Sous vide is one that is kind of, it's as foolproof as it gets, really. I mean,
yeah.
That I love. I know it's been knocked in culinary circles. Sous vide is knocked as like a simple man's way to produce good meats. But boy, it's great for folks like me who have a family, or you kind of want a foolproof way to get it to the right temperature and the right, in this case, the right tenderness. It just is. It's a great. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's kind of the easiest and best way in this case.
Yeah, and I think it gets knocked in the foodie chef world, because people are using it to cook something that can easily be done on the stovetop. And I think what's very different about wild game is that, well, one, it's way tougher than a domestic, and then two, it lacks all the fat. And so when you cook at anything at a medium temperature or high temperature with wild game, it dries out really fast. And sous vide, you're able to keep a constant low temperature that really, really benefits that meat. And I think it's, for something like braising, tenderizing a thigh, I think it's just really hard to beat.
Yep. Do you do anything different, you know, for thighs? Some years, last year I did a slow smoked barbecue turkey thigh. It was better than, it was good, I would say. It wasn't great. It didn't blow anybody away, but it was tasty. The meat is super dark and can be dry, but just it was like a 200 degrees on the Traeger for 3 hours, I think, and I just pasted it with barbecue rub and then barbecue sauce at the end, and it was good. It's not something I would go around.
Did you brine it beforehand?
I did, yeah. I brined all my stuff beforehand, so it was I think as good as you're gonna get, just a slow smoked turkey thigh. But is there anything that you've done differently with thighs than legs?
I mean, other than no, I think that's when it comes to, oh, well, I do this with Greater Canada Goose thighs. I confit them a lot.
Yeah.
And because a turkey thigh is so big, you would need to do it probably, I think a crock pot's easiest. And what I started doing with all of my other legs is using refined coconut oil, because it's a neutral flavor and you can get a big tub of it for really cheap, because you need a ton of fat to cover it. But you could do that. You could give it a cure, like salt and pepper, 24 hours before you cook it. Throw it in a crock pot, cover it in oil or some sort of fat, and then put it on low, like for a very long time, 12, 16 hours. And you could probably finish that on the grill. I have a recipe for comfy goose thighs that are barbecued. So like, I love Texas barbecue so much, but the thing that makes Texas barbecue so good is the fact that that brisket has a fat cap like this big on it.
Yep.
And you just don't have that with wild game. So I started curing my thighs in a salty barbecue rub, and then I would confit it. And then after it was confit, I'd take it out, dripping in fat, throw it on the grill. And you get that, like, you get all the things that you miss about barbecue and wild game, that rich, fatty, tender smokiness.
I always had that problem with Texas barbecue. I'm like, this tastes fine, but like, as somebody who eats only wild game mostly other than this, the flavor profile is so different. It's just such a salty, fatty mess that it's just not what I'm used to. I don't appreciate it as much as I think most people in Texas do. I was never a huge fan of brisket when I lived there, which is, I know, sacrilegious, and good thing I've already moved out of the state. But I just, for that reason, it was the flavor profile and even the thought of, you know, that much fat on a piece of meat wasn't as appealing to me. So I think everyone down there in Austin where I lived was always confused why I wasn't the first guy lining up for brisket. But I was always like, I'd rather.
No, I'm the same way. I just, the last time I had a Pinkerton's in Houston about 4 months ago, and I'm like good for barbecue for another 4 months. Yeah. Like I can only eat it. And when I do eat it, I like just gorge myself. And then I'm like, okay.
You eat it till you can't.
6 months.
There's some times where I went to barbecue places. There's a lot of really good ones in Austin, the folks that go down there. But I would go to, say, Valentina's, Tex-Mex or whatever. Valentina's Barbecue. And I would come back and like I couldn't breathe for the rest of the day.
Sounds like coronavirus.
Yeah. I was like, I remember just asking people, should I be concerned that I can't catch my breath? And I'm pretty sure it's because I ate too much salty meat. So yeah, that's our aside on Texas barbecue. But
you ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. Hey, Steve here. I want to talk about something crucial for any outdoor enthusiast, which is battery reliability. I've got Interstate batteries powering my gear. I have Interstate batteries in my camper. I run an Interstate battery in my boats. I use Interstate batteries because the last thing I want is to be left powerless. Interstate batteries isn't just another battery company. They are outrageously dependable. In Alaska, the boat dealer that we use for getting stuff and repairs, he uses Interstate. Whether you're gearing up for hunting season, planning your next RV trip, or getting your boat ready, Interstate has the battery for all your needs. With over 150,000 dealer locations, the power you need is always nearby. Interstate batteries aren't just about power. It's about being prepared for any situation. Don't let a dead battery ruin your adventure. Head over to interstatebatteries.com. Use their store locator and equip yourself with a battery that won't let you down. When you're out in the wild or just on your daily commute, an Interstate battery is your key to a dependable journey.
I guess you should move on to the crown jewel of the turkey, which is the turkey breast.
The tail.
The crown jewel of the tail. Hey, listen, you've already moved the you've moved the sponge up the field, probably. a good ways from where it started. So maybe you're going to be the person who gets the tail into the kitchen of every Meat Eater fan.
Oh, yeah.
You could do it.
I see it now.
I know. Breasts are like the each lobe of the breast, like to me, they're prized meat. I have always had the goal to kill 10 turkeys in a single year because I thought that would replace all my family's white meat consumption. My wife is very... You know, she loves wild game and would only eat that, but every once in a while she'll try to force turkey on me, or like a store-bought turkey, or a, you know, chicken breast from an organic chicken breast or something like that. Much like Steve Rinella has always said to me, like, I abhor that. It makes me just angry that it's in my house, but I also can't argue with her that we should have white meat and red meat in our diets throughout the year. And so it's kind of put me on. I don't have as much access to quail as I did when I lived in Texas, but there are plenty of grouse around here. So I try to supplement as much as I can, but
rabbits,
we got that too. I got a bunch of rabbits in my freezer now. So I'm trying to just, I've been over the last 3 years trying to get to 10, because I know if I get to 10, I'm well set for a year. But I've only ever gotten to 6.
That's a lot of turkeys.
I know. And it seems like we eat them so fast, though, around here. So I think 10 is still the number. But talk to people about the beautiful, wonderful, delicious turkey breast. What should you like to do with it?
So the first thing I do is cut them in half crosswise. So like at the top of the chest, if you were to hold the breast, the top of like where it reaches towards the collar wishbone, you'll notice that it's like 3 inches thick. And then as it tapers down the chest, it gets dramatically thinner. So where that line, or like as it starts to taper down, I cut it in half there. Because you can't cook one big turkey breast whole, because you will have half side way overdone while the other side is not quite done. So I just go ahead and chop it right there.
Yep.
So that's the first thing I do. And then I have actually plucked and kept the skin on before to try and cook it out. And it was a little chewy. I got the outside skin crispy, but there's just so much collagen in an older bird that's just, you just can't render it out.
Yeah.
But I will say it preserved all the juiciness in there. So it was like, it was kind of nice to have that on there.
Yeah.
But there's kind of two different things I do with it. The most common thing is pan roasting, which I actually did a cooking video about pan roasting today for halibut, but the same principle applies for turkey breast. And two of my recipes on Meat Eater are pan roasted turkey breast, but it's essentially searing it in a pan on the stove, flipping it, and then transferring it to the oven. So that's one way of doing it, just because it gives you even heating. So you get sort of that like brown on the outside without like burning or blackening the outside until the inside gets cooked. So that oven helps give you even cooking. And then for rendezvous, I actually cubed it up and marinated it and grilled it.
Yeah.
I did like a Spanish chorizo, like a smoky blend with some dates in there.
Oh, that was really good.
Yeah.
I was your sous chef for that. How would you grade my sous chefing?
It was 1 to 7. Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say you're a better entertainer.
You made mention of this.
Throwing things in people's mouths.
I was throwing things at people. Yeah. Like it got to be competitive, because there was like 10 tables and each table had a chef and a sous chef. And we were cooking for a bunch of people who had paid a pretty penny to be there. And other sous chefs were being more entertaining than I was. And I saw that, and I'm like, well, I'm not going to let that stand.
I don't think they were being more entertaining. I just think they got louder.
They got louder.
And then everybody else around would be like, we need to get louder too. And the next thing you know, a few drinks later in the end of the night, table 3, we're all like yelling at each other. Catch this food!
I just like, the only way I could get people excited is to throw food at them. And so that's the only, so it turned into like a middle school lunchroom at the end, which is fine with me. But yes, I love that dish. And I actually went back home and copied that and made it for my family. I think later in the summer, we were sitting out on the porch eating that. So it was great. Yeah. But have you done this? This is something, I'm a big slicer, a proponent of the slicer from Weston, the commercial meat slicer.
I've seen that.
Do you have one yet?
No, I don't.
Yeah, slicer life. You it changes everything. You'll want to slice. I slice so many things. Everything I cook, I slice. I don't know why, but I do. It's an addiction I have.
I should do that. I really should.
Yeah, the Weston slicer. If you're out there and you want to, you need this in your life. I really
do. What do? You smoke the breast and then do you chill it before you slice it?
Yeah, I usually let it. Yep. So I'll smoke the breast. I'll put whatever rub I'm feeling at that time. I usually love like a spicy pepper rub or a fennel. I have a fennel pepper rub that I use that's really good. And then just on the Traeger slow smoked for And we didn't, you know, we missed the tenderloins too. We should talk about those, but I'll generally slow smoke it on the Traeger at 200 for a couple hours. Once it comes to temp, then I'll let it rest and cool, set it in the fridge for a while, just so it's cool to the touch. And then it's, you know, set it right in the slicer and go to work. And you get that, you know, if you're looking for that beautiful little pink smoke ring on the outside, and there's plenty of juiciness that you can get from that slow a smoke. It's perfect. And for me, it replaces any lunch meat we have in our house. Cause you can, my son loves it. For a 3-year old to love anything food related is a miracle. That's not processed. he loves it. So I'll take it and lay it out in a vacuum seal bag and vacuum seal it up in it, you know, and that's our lunch meat. And it's awesome.
That's awesome.
It's perfect. And so that's why, you know, that's why for me, we go through turkeys a lot quicker, because that's, we're, you know, having the, you know, doing, we do a lot of fried, we do a fried turkey breast, or, you know, a million different things, but we're generally eating it faster because we're slicing it up for lunch meat.
Yeah, I can see that.
I would, I would very, very, even if you don't have a slicer, you can do it with a regular sharp kitchen knife. That's just as well. Just make sure it's plenty sharp, and you can throw it in a vacuum seal bag and vacuum seal, and it'll keep for 10 days or more, for sure. A couple of weeks, easy. So it's a nice little solution should you find yourself eating slimy packaged crap ever. I also do that now with venison. Same thing. Smoke it, slice it, vacuum seal it, have it for sandwich meat all year round.
I do that. I have a recipe with the roast. Except I sous vide it instead, and I do like a prime rib sandwich, and then I make a little au juice with it.
Yep.
Some horseradish mayo.
Yeah, and for those of you, like, I did a sirloin tip off a mule deer the other night, and it was the best. I mean, just slow smoked it, and then I sliced it into medallions for dinner, and then took the rest of it into the slicer for lunch meat, and it was fantastic. So we had it with eggs the next day. We had it for dinner with a bunch of asparagus and mashed cauliflower. The next day we had it for breakfast with eggs and toast, and then we had it for lunch in kind of like a roast beef sandwich type of scenario, as people would be used to, with little horseradish and cheddar cheese and a brioche bun. So, like, that was one sirloin
tip. That sounds good.
It was good, man.
Man, sirloin tip doesn't get enough credit. I really like that cut. It's like it's up there. Yesterday I did some with the top round too, and I'm like, why aren't we talking more about top rounds of sirloin tips?
Why? That's what I'm saying. I say that all the time. Like, once you learn once you learn how to butcher even a bottom round, like once you learn how to take apart a hind quarter on, you know, really any ungulate, in this case like an elk sirloin tip is huge.
How big is it?
I'll show you with my hands. Nobody can see this, but I mean, it's big as, it's, you know, roughly that big. It's huge.
Yeah.
I'd have to weigh one out to know exactly what it is, but I mean, you're looking at a big chunk of bottom round, which you can certainly cut into steaks. Top round is beautiful, you know, smoked whole like that, or even pan roasted whole like that. And then once, like I said, once you have a slicer to slice it thin, and kind of that you could save it in that sandwich portion, or really for any other purpose, it really does make it more versatile. And when I pull out a round of any kind, I'm excited. I'm as excited as a backstrap at this point.
Yeah. I actually go through all my other stuff faster than my backstrap, which is really nice, because summer rolls around and you're like ready to grill. I'm like, it's nice to have backstrap in the summer.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good thing. And I know we're doing a bunch of content at Meat Eater in the future to kind of help people through some of this, but that really is, that's why it's really nice to go through the whole turkey. It's a little simpler than a whole elk or a whole deer, but it's just nice to know, to have that versatility, to understand when you look at this animal what it can bring to your plate, and then know, like, what times of year are you interested in cooking. I save all my turkey legs for the winter, because I'm always crock-potting them or stewing them up or pulling them, and so usually I'll keep them for that time of year, and I'm keeping my breasts for the summertime, because I love having like sliced turkey and macaroni cheese or some sort of like more summery dish. So
I still have my last my last piece of meat from last year. Do you know how I was saying I cut those lobes in half?
Yep.
Those bottom portions, yep, I pounded out, and then I'm going to do this year. I'm going to do buffalo fried sandwiches, turkey sandwiches.
Ooh.
I love,
that is
one thing that I just like, buffalo, like beer and some buffalo wings. Like, I really dig that. So I'm going to do that with my turkey.
Well, and don't forget the tenderloins. The poor tenderloins. Yeah. Buried underneath.
Those are awesome.
Breast. I know. I love them, man. Especially, like, you want to talk about something you can lightly fry in a skillet with a little bit of oil and have it come out delicious. Turkey tenderloin. Man.
Yeah. They're sizable too.
Yeah. So is there any other, you just usually cook them simple on a grill, or is there something you've done with those that are?
Yeah. There's a recipe on Meat Eater. I took the tendons out and then I made some sort of marinade. Oh. It's like a smoky molasses. I know this sounds really weird, but I use molasses.
No, I'm into it.
I don't remember exactly. I do so many recipes that I don't entirely remember what I do anymore.
I was going to say, you can tell people that don't visit our site, even people that do visit our site every week or day or whatever, don't see the amount of content that you put out, because it is substantial.
It's a lot.
It is a lot.
Yeah, but I did a marinade and just threw the tenderloins on a grill. That was good. I like to eat a lot of like Middle Eastern, like Greek food. So I'll get like some naan bread and I'll throw that on the grill, and then have like some Greek yogurt-y, garlicky stuff inside that.
Whoa.
That's really good. Lebanese food.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if there's no excuse at this point, everybody. Like, if you're not cooking the whole turkey, you know, beak to tail at this point, you're not we're so deep in the quarantine now.
What's the thing that hangs off the,
oh, you could do snood to tail, snood to tail, waddle to tail, major caruncle to tail, whatever you want to do, it's fine. At this point, it's up to you guys. Don't eat the face. You probably can't eat the face. Maybe you could, who knows. But yeah, making stock, cooking your tenderloin. I mean, there's so much you can do with a turkey. So it's hopefully, as long as all the seasons stay open and we can all go out and do our thing, this should get you way more excited about what the end result can be. And if you're not already, follow Danielle at Wild and Whole. You probably already are. Hope you are. And then, you know, all of her work on themeateater.com is there weekly, if not biweekly. So don't miss any of that. Don't be dumb. Get over there. Thanks, Danielle.
You're welcome. Thanks, Ben.
What's I know I before we let you go, I know I saw you were gardening. I know you're cooking your ass off. Like, what's this quarantine? How have you handled this quarantine, and what's the future look like? What are you planning for the future? I guess you can answer either or both at the same time.
I don't want to be insensitive to everything going on right now, but honestly, I love quarantine. is that okay to say?
Well, you have to explain yourself. You have to explain it further, but yeah, it's fine.
I'm an introverted person, so like, this is fun. This is good for me. I like this. But I've been working at home for 2 years now, so nothing's really changed there. And when I'm not working, I'm usually outside doing something. So not a lot has changed other than not hanging out with my friends a little bit. But so we've got a ranch about an hour outside of Houston. And we drive up there, and we planted a big garden this year. So my first, like, big garden that's, like, not little container gardens or herbs. So I've got sweet red corn, okra, zucchini, squash, cucumbers, a lot of radish. I love radishes.
Me too.
And a lot of tomatoes and peppers. The whole bush beans, the whole works. A lot of stuff.
Well, good.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that too. My wife and I were plotting and scheming yesterday and today in the early morning, just kind of looking out across our yard, like, what are we going to do with this? What are we going to do with that? Mm-hmm. So we're excited, and hopefully everybody this spring can try a bunch of Danielle's recipes. I hope you kill a turkey. I hope you get to try recipes. And don't forget my turkey cordon bleu that hopefully everyone can try.
Is that on the Meat Eater website?
It's not, but I'll give people my personal cell phone and they can call me and I'll walk them through it.
That's awfully nice of you.
I feel so strongly about that recipe. I'm willing to do it for a period of at least 2 months. Just call me. No matter the time, and I'll walk you through it. Well, thank you, Danielle. Stay in touch, and we're going to have you on more often. This was awesome. I am sorry that you hadn't been on to this time. So
I'm glad to be here.
We'll make it a regularly scheduled addition to the show. So thanks, and we'll talk really soon.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
Bye.
Bye.
That's it. That is all. Thanks again to Danielle Pruitt for joining me. Well, that was a really cool conversation. I love talking to her. I love spending time with her, man. She has the right outlook on this stuff, even though she is fairly new to hunting in our world. She brings the freshest of fresh perspectives, and I really enjoy talking to her. Phil, thank you for earlier in the podcast. Thanks for the pep talk, man. I don't want to let this possible loss of turkey season get me down. I'm going to keep hammering.
Yeah, I mean, you have no choice but to look on the bright side. I mean, technically, you have more than that choice, but that's the best choice.
Yes, technically, you are correct. And that's really all we can do. I will say, in terms of what a couple people have been asking me about via email, we have not forgotten about our podcast giveaway. At all. I have not forgotten about the podcast giveaway. I still have that podcast kit. I haven't sold it. I haven't given it away. And I definitely am going to get to that when our regular show resumes. I want to have our winner on and talk to him and do some more things. Same thing with the New Zealand hunting contest. I've been in talks with First Light about what we could do with that. We're thinking of some creative things. We're not going to do it this year, but we are going to do it next year. And so we're going to think of some creative things and ways to announce the winner of that too. So stay tuned for those two things. It's a little bit of housekeeping, but we're going to trudge forward here on the Hunting Collective Daily Quarantine Cast. Tomorrow is number 14. So hopefully you stick around. We'll see you then. Enjoy the rest of your day. Bye-bye.
The Hunting Collective with Ben O'Brien is a part of the Meat Eater Podcast Network. It is produced by Corinne Schneider and engineered by Phil Taylor. You can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, themeateater.com, or anywhere podcasts are downloadable. Wherever you listen, leave a 5-star review and subscribe.
So, Phil, I've been watching a lot of TV. I usually read a good amount of books, but some reason the quarantine has like left me just to watch TV. So I watched all of Lonesome Dove, the miniseries. I've watched all of Band of Brothers, and I'm working my way through some Ken Burns documentaries. I'm like an old guy.
Fun. TV.
And after Tiger King, I needed some normal shit to watch. What are you watching over there?
Oh man. Well, I've been doing a poor job of watching. I don't know if you're aware of this, Ben, but I'm a hashtag gamer. I play video games.
Oh my God.
Please don't refer to me as a gamer. But I've been playing a lot of this game called Bloodborne. You ever heard of this, Ben?
Nope. Shut down the podcast. Shut down the podcast. We're losing listeners. Help.
Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate Batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate Batteries. I use Interstate Batteries in my boats. I use Interstate Batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.